This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers, who is, for the first time, in almost the same time zone as I am. I'm recording from Chicago today. We're still not actually in the same time zone, but that's an unfortunate fact of the incredible size of this country. We have two sponsors tonight. The first one is the Stop Getting IT Wrong book, which is a great book all about ideas and musings, whinings and strategies about the use of technology in the classroom. We'll tell you a little more about that as the show goes on. And our friends at Jam Software are back again with another spot highlighting some of their new innovations that go along with iOS 7. We'll talk about them during the show as well. How are you doing, Bradley?
Great. It is. It's strange to be this close to you, but yet so far away. It's the crazy thing about the U.S. is you're still an 11-hour drive from me.
I know. I can't even begin to actually understand how large this is. I mean, if you drive 11 hours from my house in any direction, your car's in the sea. But not here.
Well, what's crazy is there are parts of Florida that will take me, and just for our listeners, like it's like I'm in Chattanooga, Tennessee, so there are parts of Florida that it would take me 11 hours to get to, and it just seems kind of like disproportional. I guess it's just like the way the freeway system works, but like it seems like it should either take like 30 hours to get to Chicago, or it should take like 5 hours to get all the way down south, but it's just, yeah, the U.S. is weird, I guess.
Are, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, it's I survived the flight. I was flying BA out of Heathrow. Recently been through Heathrow with my South African trip, and going back through Heathrow was actually much worse than coming out of Heathrow. So we survived the flight, though. I was on a nearly new Boeing 777, which had this really interesting new in-seat entertainment system, which was pretty cool. It had these 3D maps that you could control yourself. The older planes just have one that moves and you can't control it, but this is an interactive map, which was pretty cool. And I think one of the interesting things about this trip is that I'm traveling iOS only. So we are not only am I presenting with iOS only, but we're also recording the show iOS only as well. So the actual kind of setup for the show is quite interesting. I'm recording on my iPad using an app called Aria, which is a pretty powerful digital audio workstation for iOS, which is really cool. We've tried that once before, had a couple of issues with it, but we're going to try it again tonight. And then the actual call is happening over Skype from my iPhone, so it's an all iOS show today, all American show. And what are we going to talk about?
Yeah, American made for today, for the first time. Well, I guess we can start with, some iOS 7 follow-up. I'm about halfway through my upgrade to it internally. Of course, as we mentioned on the last show, 7.02 would probably come out, and it did. Mm-hmm. But, I'm about halfway through my upgrade. I will do the remainder this afternoon. But to be honest, with 7.02 being a Delta update, and it's relatively small, I'm considering on the ones I've already done, just doing those over the air, because I can kind of just, while the device is still on 6.0 or 6.1 point whatever, mm-hmm, or upgrading to 7, I can just kind of set those on a table and get those things going. So that's probably my plan. So I hope to be iOS 7 completely by the end of the day. I've actually had a couple of students ask me when I'm going to be upgrading everybody's devices.
Week.
So.
Yeah.
I guess they expect like just day one, like it's just like there. I don't know, but maybe.
Yeah, I had one student ask me whether or not once they had iOS 7 on their iPad, if they could unlock it with their fingerprint. I said, I wish it was that simple.
Well, they're going to be upset when the new iPads come out with has the Touch ID, and your current iPads are going to feel really old.
Yeah, they're going to be pieces of junk within a month.
It's like, is there something to trade in, policy? Of course, I had that issue with my Mac. Like, I got the 2012 MacBook Air in March. And, of course, in June or July, they made the new ones. They released the new ones. And it's like my MacBook Air just suddenly feels really out of date.
Yeah.
But,
well, that new battery life is pretty hot.
Yes.
I've done most of our devices. We've obviously got the split deployment where some are institutional model and some are personal model. And for the personal model kids, I had a really interesting experience actually, which was I basically said to everybody, look, check that your iCloud backups are up to date, and just go for it. Just do it on your device. Do it over there. Do it at home if you wouldn't mind, but go ahead and do it. And what I found with that actually was really interesting was that quite a lot of kids did not have current iCloud backups, even though we had turned it on for everybody in the rollout day. And what it turned out to be was that their parents were in the habit of turning off the Wi-Fi overnight. So obviously when iOS wants to connect to Wi-Fi and power and be locked at the same time, usually at night time, and then do the update, they were not getting the Wi-Fi. So we had to kind of set up a procedure where kids could come into school and hit the backup button every so often as well. But we'll probably write back to parents and say, you know, please consider leaving the Wi-Fi on overnight so your kids can back up.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I had a staff member that, you know, iCloud backups can be kind of tricky for how great they are. But we had a staff member that she got a iPhone 5S and she had a 4S previously. She came to me and she said, hey, like, my iCloud backup is saying it's full, but like, I don't know what it is. And like it said, it was using 6.1 gigabytes, but she, like, her camera roll had like 500 megs. I mean, like, she had every app turned off, but it was still full. And what I deduced it was is she had never deleted a message, an iMessage thing. Okay. So you know, had basically every message that she had since, I guess, 2010 or 2011 when she got her first phone, and just kind of brought them over whenever iMessage was released. And I said, you can either delete your messages or we can do this over iTunes. And so we decided to do it over iTunes. But database. It's just,
yeah.
I didn't realize that iCloud backup was backing up those messages, but I guess it makes sense that it would. And, you know, because I'm in the habit of deleting mine when I, like, if you and I are messaging when the conversation is done, I delete it. I'm a little bit OCD.
Yeah, I'm lazy about that. But you're not as bad as a friend of mine who deletes every calendar appointment she has after they happen.
No, I do that too.
Really?
I could not. Well, you notice that. On our the calendar that we use to schedule the shows, like, I delete the old ones.
That's how I
don't know why I do. I don't know why I do that. Like, in my head, it's because I think that the syncing works faster if there aren't, like, old appointments on there. And I don't know why, like, I think that, but that's just, I have some OCD issues.
Just one or two.
I don't know why. Yeah. The biggest thing, because I blogged about this and I wrote it 5 times, is when you are going to do the upgrade is to, if you're upgrading over configurator, is to make sure you have 1.4, which came out the day after iOS 7. I would have liked to have seen that day one, mm-hmm. but, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah, that hit me. I kind of messed up one iPad with that, and then I kind of put a halt on it until I figured out what the problem was. But yeah, if you try and use 1.3.1 to update iOS 7, it can get a bit messy pretty quickly. Did you have any issues with 1.4?
No, but I actually have my configurator machine next to me, and there's something that I kept seeing yesterday, and it's still saying that when I launch it, I'm at the all devices mm-hmm. screen under the supervised mode. I have update iOS to when available, and on restore, it's got the backup that I made. And so it's like, it's acting like it's going to restore it. And so I go in and change that to don't restore backup. But if I close configurator and reopen it, it defaults back to restoring from backup. And I don't know why.
I wonder if that's just a UI problem. It seems like something to test on one iPad first. I deliberately set all of ours back to don't restore anything once I configured them the first time. That can be an issue that catches some people, actually. You know, why is my iPad just getting wiped back? Well, if you set your iPad to restore to a certain backup every time they're refreshed, then that's what's going to happen. But I didn't have any problems with 1.4, except a few interesting issues with what it was telling me it was doing versus what it was actually doing. When you expand the view of an iPad that's being updated, what I saw was it came up and said, preparing to redeem code for, and it would name every single app on the device. And I think what it was doing there was just checking that those codes had been redeemed. And I thought it had basically wanted to reinstall all the apps. because it was reinstalling some apps, but in fact, or I thought it was reinstalling some apps. What it was actually doing was updating apps because there was a newer version and configurator than there was on the iPads that I was dealing with. So it was actually doing the right thing, but it just looked like the way it was reporting it, the way the language was written, it looked like it was going to reinstall every app again, which was a nervous moment. But in fact, it worked perfectly. Functionally, it was fine.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you just, these things, like, if you screw up and you have to, like, redo something, it can just take so much time to fix.
Yeah, you know, the easy path is 5 minutes, and the wrong path is 2 hours. You know, that's the risk.
The some of the new, you know, I went in and tweaked our configuration profile, and some of those new things are interesting. You know, you've got the web content filter, which we can talk more about, and then the AirPlay mirroring and the AirPrint. The you can basically control what AirPrint printers that the device can print to, which I love in theory, but it doesn't seem to be compatible with Printopia. Like, that's how I'm sharing our multifunction devices to our iOS devices. And when I go in, and it can find it, if you change it to be, like, you know, basically search for it, it just basically says, like, let me try to do it, see what it says. It says, could not resolve resource path. And if I type in the actual IP address of the printer, it doesn't work either.
Right.
But that's probably a Printopia issue, more so than...
improve the emulation a little bit or something, just to make that work right. I haven't tried that myself, because we've only got one printer for the whole school, so I haven't bothered restricting it or setting it up for anybody. But that will be useful, you know, for people who do have many, many printers. Just making sure that your iPads can print to certain ones, but maybe not to all of them, will be useful.
Let's see. Okay, so the next thing that, if you look under the restrictions section, there's quite a few new options there that I kind of tweaked some of those. The you can control Find My Friends, you can limit ad tracking, and then you can allow supervised devices to pair with non-configurator host. And I'm assuming that means that you would allow supervised devices to sync with another iTunes. Is that what that's saying?
Yes, I think it is. The word pairing is not one that I'm familiar with in terms of iOS administration so far, but I think this is the first time I've seen that used. But yes, I think that's essentially, it's the workaround for the problem where if you had supervised devices, you couldn't pull videos off the camera roll using image capture on any other Mac. You had to go back to the configurator machine. So that's basically what that means, is you can set that up now. But there's actually some controls to go along with it as well, so you can say which hosts, I think, like which Macs you can connect to as well. Is that right?
I didn't see it. Again, thankfully, I have my configurator machine right next to me. So, yeah, it looks like it's just a checkbox. And if I check it, let's see if it does. It doesn't really allow me to change any options. It just has a checkbox next to allow pairing with non-configurator host. So, I don't know. That would be something I'd love to test.
That needs a little bit of experimentation as well.
I would love to see, like, a good iBook about configurator, like just something from Apple, like basically saying, here's all what all that stuff means, and here's the settings and whatnot. So, of course, we've also got some greater controls on Notification Center for you can show Control Center and lock screen, show Notification Center and lock screen, and show the Today View and lock screen. Mm-hmm. So I have those turned off. You know, one option I'd love to see is to turn off all push notifications on a device. Like, basically say this device does not receive any push notifications, because right now it's kind of... kind of more granular, like each app you have to ask permission and change permission. I would love to see just a kind of a blanket off.
What would you use that for?
Well, like if you've got like a, shared deployment, it's like you've got all these apps that are saying, some of these even educational apps are saying like, hey, don't forget to launch to learn about the word of the day or something, something like that. It's just like, I don't care about that.
I think, you know, what would be really nice is if you had a button on the end of those notifications that said report this person to Apple for abusing notifications and take their app off the store. I would much rather have something like that, but I guess we're not going to get that. Notifications are an interesting one, though, because now with iOS 7, so much of the background functionality of the OS runs through push notifications. I don't know if you've noticed this when you... where did I notice it? It was when I reinstalled Evernote. What it said was, it would said Evernote. It popped up and said Evernote can sync your notes in the background with push notifications, and then you okayed that. And then the standard system, this app wants to send you push notifications, comes up, and then you've got to okay that. But I've seen this in a couple of different apps. I think Pocket does it as well, where they have to kind of explain why you're about to see a push notification dialogue, because even though these notifications are silent and in the background and they don't do anything, they don't show anything to the user. The system still requests the same permissions as if you were doing an interrupting notification. And I think that's maybe a little bit of a mistake, because if the notifications are only going to be silent ones, then I think they should be allowed silently rather than... Because it's confusing. And I think in some ways, apps that don't obviously send you notifications are now and should be under suspicion now, because so many apps do that. You know, it's like, hey, this game wants to send you a notification, and the notifications are only about adverts. And I think the problem that some developers are going to have is that, you know, if you have a to-do list that appears to want to send notifications to a user, or, you know, a word processor that wants to send notifications to a user, people are going to say, no, that sounds like I'm just going to get spammed, so I'm just going to turn that off, and then your background syncing won't work. So I think there's maybe a little bit of refinement in the user setup process that has to happen there in iOS 7.
I was thinking about that kind of whole background process today, and there's really three places that you can kind of get tripped up with it. Like, you've got to obviously allow the push notifications. Then there's the background app usage settings in the settings app, where you can turn apps off, on and off individually. And then you actually have to leave the app running. And I think even though it's wrong, a lot of people for years have close their apps and they're not using them. And I think kind of even more so now, because you don't just see the icon, you actually see the app. So people's natural thing is just to kind of close applications. Again, even though that was wrong in iOS, you know, 4, 5, and 6, or I guess that maybe came in 5, I don't remember. But there's kind of like three places you have to basically leave an app running for it to receive background updates. And I would just like to be able to say, like, you know, one checkbox that says Evernote can do what it wants to in the background. You know, within the limits of the OS, regardless if I have it running in the multitasking tray switcher or not. And I think, you know, you and I understand that, but I think a lot of regular people are just closing their applications, and then they're not getting to take advantage of these background updates.
Yeah, it's something that needs a little bit of refinement, I think, but and perhaps a little bit of user education as well, because one of the things I thought about doing was kids asked me, oh, how do you kill an app now? I was really tempted just to say, you can't do that in iOS 7. Just don't worry about it. But, you know, somebody would eventually find it out anyway, so what can you do?
Yes. Well, it's swiping up isn't like the natural thing. I've had that question multiple times. But that I think this could be interesting in the classroom, because let's say you got an app like Pages that before you had to open and wait for it to download your new documents, if you'd say worked on another device, now they should theoretically be just up to date when you open them.
Yeah, that seems to actually be working already. I noticed this when I'd edited some Keynote files on my iPad and then went to open my phone, switched to Keynote, and I was waiting for it to do its syncing thing, and it never did. And I thought, is this broken? And it turned out it was actually, it had already done it. All the updates were already there. So it seems like the iCloud document syncing stuff is already being pushed in the background, even if the apps themselves haven't necessarily been updated for 7.
Oh, yeah. I guess if they're using like the documents data, not necessarily just like their own, you know, like an app like Evernote that doesn't use iCloud would have to be updated. Yes. But if it's using iCloud as its syncing method, it already works. Because obviously Keynote's not been updated for iOS 7.
And that's an interesting issue, actually. I don't know when we might see that. But it feels a bit weird to me right now that almost none, in fact, I think none of Apple's App Store apps have been updated for iOS 7. I wonder if that's a thing that we're going to see alongside a potential iPad announcement quite soon.
I would say so, because I look at iWork as more of an iPad app with a kind of... It also has an iPhone app. Like, you know, obviously, I think the iPad Keynote is more popular and sees more usage than the iPhone version. Yeah. So I think it would make more sense to introduce it with a possibly new iPad.
And of course, historically, all of those apps have been introduced alongside iPads. You know, iWork came with the first iPad, and then we had iMovie and GarageBand with the iPad 2, and then iPhoto with the Retina iPad, and so on. And I think it would be interesting if Apple just, you know, said, here's you know, sort of reset the expectations a little bit and said, you know, here's all our new apps for iPad as well, and just showed some of the sort of power features they can put into the, whatever the new iPad is going to have in the future.
I've seen some different, I've updated quite a few devices, and it seems like half of them have automatic updates on by default, and it seems like the other half have them off, and I've not figured out what the reasoning there is. Have you noticed anything like that?
I have not noticed that. I haven't gone looking for it either, though. Now, are you talking about institutional managed iPads where the App Store is available? Because we're turning the App Store off on our iPads at the moment.
Well, yeah, I guess I should clarify that it's our non-institutional devices. Like it's you know, like my wife's and I, and then the people's phones I've helped them upgrade. Like it's, because I always go and check that to see. Yeah, because our App Store is off as well. Of course, I don't have an iPad with me, but so I wonder if I guess apps still can't update in the background though. If the App Store is off.
I think that's correct. I have not checked yet, but I think that's correct that if the App Store is off, then background updates will also be off.
So, like, I know, like, my phones, for my wife and mine's phone, for example, had the App Store auto updates off, but then I checked some other people's, they had just upgraded and they were on. So I don't know, like, what the reasoning there is, because obviously you want it to be on, I would think. But I could see why they would make it off by default. But when things are off by default, that means that most people don't get them.
Off by default means off forever for 90% of the users.
So before we move on, let's take a quick sponsor break and thank our sponsor this week. It's the Stop Getting IT Wrong book. Been with us for a couple weeks now. It's a great book, really, really inexpensive. It's basically a book by a teacher for teachers about using technology in the classroom. So it's a great collection of, you know, various stories and strategies about the successful use of using digital technology in any classroom at any level, whether it's a computer science class, a history tech class, a dance class, a computer class, whatever you want to do, this is the book for you. It collects the best practices of over 7 years in teaching with computers and digital technology every day, brought to you by a passionate teacher who genuinely believes that every lesson can be made better by using the technology that we already have at our fingertips. Stop Getting IT Wrong is available from Amazon as a paperback. It's also available as a Kindle book, and it's also now available on the iBook store. The paperback book is $9.99 in pounds or $13.38 in dollars, and the Kindle book is $2.99 in pounds or $4.66 in dollars, and I believe it's the same as on the iBook store. So if you're waiting for the iBooks version of Stop Getting IT Wrong, it's now available. And you can learn more about the book at stopgettingitwrong.com, and we'll have a link to that book in the show notes at outofschool.net.
Okay.
So what? Talk to us about your content filter.
Yeah, so I have been testing that. That's kind of been my focus since iOS 7 dropped, is having a look at how the web filter behaves. And I have found it to be probably too effective, shall we say. It certainly works. You can turn it on either through restrictions on the device itself, or you can turn it on through configuration profile if you're a supervised device. And what it does basically, and we mentioned this in the last show, is that it at a very low level filters network traffic through whatever browser it comes through, so Chrome, Safari, some other device, some other app with an embedded web view, all of those will be filtered. But what I found was that I basically turned it on my phone and tried to live with it to see how often I would bump into the filter, and the answer was all the time. It's incredibly conservative filter. In my opinion, far too conservative. But perhaps it's possible that this is a learning thing, that the initial set of data is not very good until you ship iOS 7 and get a bunch of examples from people and so on. One of the things I found was that if you set it up through restrictions on the device itself, when you get the filter page, you get a link that you can type in the restrictions passcode and you get past the filter, if your site gets filtered. If you do it through restrictions, there's no workaround. If you do it through configuration profile, there's no workaround because the restrictions pin code hasn't necessarily been set up on the device. So I found it to be restrictive to the point of unusable. So we pushed it out to our kids for a little while, got a few complaints, but you know, before I got the complaints, I realised myself how invasive it was and decided to turn it off again preemptively. But you know, going forward, maybe it can be softened a little bit, maybe it can be eased off, and maybe it'll just learn a bit more. I presume there's some kind of mechanism for updating its rule set, although it's not exposed to anybody on the device how that works. But I think with a little bit of refinement, it could be a nice, useful tool. But I think right now, it is a little bit rough and a little bit over-aggressive for general use.
Well, yeah, you'd like to see some sort of, you know, kind of dial where you could say, you know, basically just do adult content, or maybe some sort of like checkbox. I know OpenDNS and Arsonical has that, where you can block various categories. So you could say just block adult content, or block like adult content and guns and weapons, and kind of maybe more select categories that it would try to learn from. But no, it would be nice to see you know, some more granular control, because again, it could be very, very useful. But a too aggressive filter is just, in my opinion, just as bad as no filter, because it impacts the device so much.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, I'm not sure what I want to say about that. I think it's implemented at the right level. And I think it's at the right level in the system to solve a problem that does exist, which is the issue of lots of different apps having built-in web views that can surf the web. And this handles all of those, but it's got to be, it's got to not be so intrusive that it breaks the internet, you know. And I think you're right, a little more granular control, because it was blocking crazy things. You know, it was blocking like the Guardian news website, it was blocking my blog, it was blocking, you know, just random web forums that you went to, that it kind of felt a little almost paranoid to me, just the kind of things it was trying to block. Because the problem for Apple is, I guess, when you're Apple and you've just promised to keep people's children safe on the internet, then any breach of that is going to be a PR problem.
Well, and you think about, like, what kind of options could they put in to help us? And maybe it's something like, you know, what age limit, or what are the age range of the person using this iPad, or the person you're trying to protect? Like, mm-hmm. You know, because if you're doing something that's like blocking, if this is aimed at high school students, obviously it would be, you'd put less restrictions than if it was like on a first grade student.
Yes. Yep.
Because they're going to different kind of websites. And so if you could, you know, thinking through the educational mindset, because you don't want to basically have a whitelisted internet. I mean, that's not, the web is too big for Apple to do something like that.
Yeah. There is actually a feature where you could do that. I mean, that's one of the modes that you can deploy it in, is you can say only these bookmarks that I've put into the filter can be allowed, and everything else is forbidden. But that's, like you said, that's only useful in such a limited set of circumstances. And I think really what that's there for is, if you were providing like a kiosk iPad where you only wanted the users to get to like your company's website, I think that would be the right approach for that. But for general use, I think it's got to be the automatic filter with a lot more smarts than it has at the moment, or something at the network level.
I think you're cutting in and out on me.
Speaking of web filtering and issues around that, I don't know if you saw the story, Bradley, this week about the Los Angeles school district hacking scandal. Did you see that?
I did, and had quite a long conversation with some folks on Twitter about it. People, and of course, everybody, the ones I saw, people were just mainly, you know, talking about this iOS's fault and this, that, and the other. But there's more there to meets the eye.
Yeah, I think so. Now, we'll put a link in the show notes to the story that I first read about it, which was in the LA Times, I believe.
Yes.
Where they basically gave the story, they broke the story, using a particular set of phrases, if you like, none of which I think were particularly helpful in terms of what they did. Basically, what they were saying, now let me see if I can find my note on this, because I did clip that story a little bit. There we go. Yeah, so let me just read from the story. It says, following news that the students at a Los Angeles high school had hacked district-issued iPads and were using them for personal use, district officials have halted home use of the Apple tablets until further notice. It took exactly 1 week for nearly 300 students at Theodore Roosevelt High School to hack through security so they could surf the web on their new school-issued iPads, raising new concerns about a plan to distribute the devices to all students in the district. I mean, at the first level, you know, the horror that children are on the web, my goodness, what a disaster. But also the phrase hacking is, I think, putting it very strongly compared to what it appears is actually done. So later on in the article, what it says is that students began to tinker with the security lock on the tablets because, quote, they took them home and they can't do anything with them, unquote, said Roosevelt Senior Alfredo Garcia. So basically what they're saying, I think, is that they locked down these iPads as hard as they could, and the kids found them boring and useless when they got them home as well. So it's quite interesting. I'm going to give you my guess as to what has actually been done here, and you can let me know if you think that this is right, Bradley. But as far as I can tell, what I think they did was that they enrolled the devices in an MDM server. They then pushed out a configuration profile that turned off Safari. And then what the kids have discovered is that if you remove the device from the MDM profile, or if you move the MDM profile from the device, then all the profiles that come through MDM will be removed. So if you take out the MDM profile, Safari comes back and you can surf the web unrestricted. That's what I think has happened. And it says in the article, it says, Roosevelt students matter-of-factly explained their technique Tuesday outside school. The trick, they said, was to delete their personal profile information. With the profile deleted, a student was free to surf. And that seems to be it. The kids have learned that MDM is not a belt and braces security solution in iOS.
Well, you know, I agree with you. That's probably what happened. And of course, I'm guessing these are iOS 6 devices, yeah, because I know in iOS 7, and I guess this wasn't in iOS 6, but in Configurator, there's a security section to control when this profile can be removed. Do MDM profiles, can they have that same restriction of not being able to be removed?
Well, the way it works is that you can turn that feature, you can turn that flag on in Configurator, but the iPad will not honor it because it's an MDM profile. So there's a very deep seated philosophical point in iOS 6 and 7 for that matter, which says that MDM is there for light touch policy application and not for draconian control. And I think the big fear at Apple has been the possibility that administrators would take people's own devices and then they would apply, they would basically capture them into MDM in such a way that they could never be released. So it's actually until some new features in iOS 7 roll out later this year, it's never been possible to enforce MDM enrollment on iOS. And I think it's possible that the LAUSD people got tripped up by that, or that they just thought that the kids will never figure out this, or maybe they didn't even know that this was, that an MDM profile is kind of a master profile for all the others. But if they had done it another way, if they had used Apple Configurator to put on the profile that said no Safari and set that to have a password or just have it never be removable, then this problem would never have arisen. Kids would not be able to get it off.
Well, it sounds like what they really wanted these devices to be was in supervised mode. And we can argue, you know, I could argue that that's a mistake, that, you know, that we shouldn't be trying to just restrict these iPads from the kids. And, you know, again, we can, and a lot of people would debate that with us, that you've got to manage all that. And but it just seems like that they were trying to control something in a way that you can't just, it's just not meant to be controlled. And so I guess you would say that's a deployment problem, because there, again, that's a lot of iPads to run through Configurator.
Well, so that is the thing, right? Is that basically what this is showing you is that Configurator doesn't scale to 50,000 seats.
No.
Yeah. Now, I think, you know, debating the policy aside, you can certainly say that there is a way in which you could have guaranteed the result that they wanted. And I think, as far as I can tell from reading the story and a couple of others around it, that basically the deployment technique was wrong for the target they were looking for, which was an absolute guarantee that students would never be able to surf the open web using these devices. I have to say, I'm a little disappointed that that was ever the plan. You know, LAUSD is obviously going to be one of the most high-profile iPad deployments in the world for maybe several years to come. I mean, they're talking about doing twice as many as the next biggest iPad deployment that I know of, which is McAllen School District in Texas, which is where they've got about 25,000 seats. And I had hoped that they would were looking at it in a broader context. Now, I think what I've seen in some sort of follow-up articles where they've talked to people closer to the educational side is that what they're saying is this is a great opportunity for us to start talking to students about e-safety and start talking to students about responsible use and appropriate use and stuff like that. And I think if that is what comes out of this PR disaster, then I think that's going to be an excellent result for LAUSD, is if it turns from a locking and blocking situation into a discussion about e-safety culture, that's going to be the best possible of all outcomes. And I hope that they get the time and the space that they need to build up that culture, because that doesn't happen overnight. That's going to take, you know, a year, a couple of years, and you will probably see a short-term spike in issues that go around that before you start to put that culture in place of respect and responsible use and so on. So fingers crossed that that works out for them. I think it's really important that the people who are involved in that get that message across to the media as well. And one would hope that the media would give them a little space to get it right too, but of course when politics are involved, as politics are always involved in these things, you know, there's somebody in the waiting in the wings just ready to destroy you as soon as the first thing goes wrong.
Yeah, and I imagine Apple is heavily working with them to try to tweak, you know, to help them out, to tweak it, but you're right, it's like they were trying to they're just basically, you know, for what they wanted, they were using the wrong tool. But I would, you and I both would argue that they what they wanted is not the best thing long term, because you've got to teach, you know, these kids one day will have access to the open web. And so you've got to teach them how to responsibly act and responsibly use devices. And I know that's easy for us to say when we have, you know, a couple hundred kids in our school. But and though they've got, you know, tens of thousands, but you've just got to start. You've got to start somewhere, and you've got to let kids surprise you with doing the right thing. Because if you just assume that they're going to do the wrong thing, then, you know, a lot of kids are going to try.
Yeah, you know what they say: catch them being good.
Yeah,
it's you know, you said one day these kids are going to have access to the open web. I mean, that day is probably 2 years ago already. You know, and I think
true.
The point is that we have to solve this problem at scale somehow, and whether it has to, and it has to be through education. You know, it's the same if there are health issues that we have to teach children about, if there are, you know, road safety issues, e-safety issues, we address them through education and through safety controls as well. You know, this isn't an argument just about, you know, free love on the internet or whatever. It's much, there's more to it than just any one simple solution, but I have to believe that part of it is building the right culture around all of these things. And that is no guarantee, but that's the price of free society, I think, isn't it?
Well, you think about, now, we don't teach driver's ed much here in the U.S. anymore, mm-hmm. but, like, think about when we did. Like, you didn't just teach them on a closed course. Like, eventually you had to teach driver's ed on the road, because that's the world they're going to live in. And so if you only teach them in a closed environment, then they're not going to know how to react to other cars coming at them. Mm-hmm. And it's really the same thing. Like, you've got to show them how to responsibly, you know, avoid this kind of content, or, you know, how, and it goes back to, again, more than just about avoiding negative content, but, like, knowing what not to say on the internet and why you shouldn't say things like that, and how that's saying it on the internet is just the same as saying it in real life, and possibly worse because it's always there. And it's just, I agree, this is an opportunity to have a broader discussion about, it's not always the right thing to lock the door and hold the keys. Sometimes you want to maybe leave the door a little cracked and leave it unlocked.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that I certainly believe, and from what I've read around this news story and the follow-up stuff, that there are people in LA who are thinking along these lines as well. I mean, this isn't unfamiliar territory to a lot of the people working inside this system and working inside this deployment. I think there are good voices in there who are going to try and get that message across, and I sincerely hope that they are able to do that, because is too important just to, because there were some people quoted who were saying, well, we're investigating a way that we can just set the iPads up so that they can only access Pearson learning materials at home. I thought, what? You know, that's like the worst possible thing to do to a student. You know, I mean, who on earth wants a Pearson only iPad? You know, it's like worse than, you know, giving them a textbook. It's like, here's an iPad that can do all this cool stuff and you're getting none of it, because all you're getting is the California State Algebra program by Pearson. I mean, you would be so upset if you heard your school was doing an iPad program and then that was what you got. I mean, it'd just be heartbreaking.
Yeah, and, you know, again, you're right that there's probably a lot of people internally fighting for one way and probably a lot of people fighting another way. Yeah. And so it's like it's external politics, but also a lot of internal politics
for
as well.
Sure. I mean, in a deployment that size, how else could it be? How else could it be?
Yeah.
I feel for the people working, you know, in the glare of media publicity. I mean, there have been situations I know of as well where this has happened on a smaller scale. And... you know, even if you push through and you get your own way, you know, the first time a pupil cracks an iPad, the press are all over you and stuff like that. And it's just, you know, it's really hard to get across to people why you need to give some freedom as well, because then, you know, you're on the hook for anything that ever goes wrong. And I think that's the toxic media and political culture we live in, I suppose, isn't it?
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
So depressing.
Yeah. Before we move on to our next topic, let's take a minute to thank our next sponsor, Jamp Software, is back again. They have announced 0-day support for the new technologies with iOS 7. So, you know, we talked about that last week. Jamp had an update that enabled iOS 7 basically options the same day. So they also now include Apple TV management. So the new version of Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, and select specific Apple TVs assigned to their class, choose and distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay right from Casper Focus. So again, they, you know, Casper Focus has been, you know, expanded, and they now include Apple TV support within Jamp or in the Casper suite. So learn more at jampsoftware.com, or if you're at ISTE, FECT, or BETT, visit their booth and you can talk to someone directly. But again, jampsoftware.com, or if you're on Twitter, it's at jampsoftware. So thanks for Jamp Software for coming back this week to sponsor the show.
Yes, indeed. We've been playing with the new Casper 9.1, and the upgrade was very smooth. Got that going fine. Excuse me. Air-conditioned rooms are killing my throat. Working really well for us. One of our primary teachers, she's using Casper Focus with her 4- and 5-year-olds and has really come to, I don't want to say depend on it, but you rely upon it to make that distinction between focus time on the iPad and free time on the iPad for those young kids. And that's working really well for her. So it's a nice update, and look forward to seeing what else they do. I tried to set up the Apple TV stuff, but I kind of ran out of time before I had to leave for this trip, and I was also a bit kind of stuck because iOS 6 for Apple TV came out, or sorry, Apple TV firmware 6.0, which is actually iOS 7 based, I think. It came out and then it was pulled again, and then it came out very late, and so on. So there was a bit of confusion about that. We only managed to update a couple of Apple TVs, but I didn't have time to sit there and figure out how to enroll the Apple TVs in MDM yet. And I think that's a minimum requirement for being able to use them with Casper Focus, is that your Casper Suite server has to know about both the class, all the iPads, and the Apple TVs in order to make that work. It doesn't work if you just have your Apple TVs on the network and only the iPads and Casper. Casper has to know about everything.
One of the things that's going to help you ongoing is to this new firmware, you can turn on auto update and software update.
Oh, for the TV? Nice.
Yes. So now none of mine, I updated all three of mine last Friday and it worked fine. But, of course, then they pulled it. And then I noticed I haven't updated two of my other ones, but like even the one I checked, it actually had a new update. So I downloaded it again, even though it was already on 6.0. Obviously, they changed something, but yeah, it has auto update. So that'll be good ongoing. So you really should never have to touch these things again once you get them on 6.0.
That's cool. I didn't know that was a feature, but I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, man. Before we get, we're getting close to here to an hour, but I wanted to mention that Evernote had a big conference this week, their kind of annual conference, and so we had some new things, had Sketch 3.0, and I know you tweeted about that this morning. What are your thoughts on Sketch?
Well, I was initially quite upset with it because I put it on my third generation iPad, and it was really laggy, but then I put it on my... I've also got my iPad mini here with me and my phone, and on the mini and the phone it was fine. I don't know if the Retina iPad was something weird with it or whatever, but I really like it. They've really simplified it, and they've also kind of bizarrely for Evernote, they've taken it kind of out of your Evernote library, which is exactly what I wanted them to do, because previously I had not really been using Sketch because I didn't want every little throwaway diagram to end up in my Evernote library. But what they've done is they've turned it into a bit more of a one-shot effort where you take or choose a picture, mark it up in Sketch, and then you share it somewhere. And the sharing can be directly to Twitter, which is what I really wanted for the most part. But you can also then just take what you've done and save it to Evernote. So in that way, it's kind of a funnel into Evernote rather than part of your Evernote system itself. I think it's going to be a really nice update.
Yeah, and they just released a point upgrade this morning, so that may fix your Retina issues. But yeah, no, I agree with you that I have been using Bugshot a lot from Marco Arment to like kind of mark up various iOS screenshots. But for the same reason, I didn't want all those living in a Sketch library. But yeah, you can send it right there. It goes into your default notebook when you send it to Evernote with the prefix from Sketch. So that'll be great. I love the last version of Sketch, but I think I like this new one even better. Then, of course, we had the Post-it note integration as well. Have you tested that out yet?
No, I have not. I don't have any Post-it notes handy, but it looks interesting.
Yeah, I use it. It's actually, they're selling Evernote-branded Post-it notes, but they're really, unlike the Moleskine Evernote product, they're really no different. Like the paper, they're exactly the same Post-it notes. The only difference is they include a free month of Evernote Premium, but it actually works pretty good. When you go to the camera on the new version of Evernote, you can swipe over and you go to the Post-it note option, and it actually does pretty nice. And I'm assuming it'll OCR it as well.
Nice. I don't know if you saw that the folks at Smile Software brought out a new app recently called PDF Pen Scan Plus.
Yes, I purchased that.
Have you found it to be pretty good?
I am using it instead of Scanner Pro so far. The main reason, it just feels like it was kind of... It basically was the aspect of Scanner Pro that I used. And so it's kind of more simplified than Scanner Pro from the folks that, who makes Scanner Pro. That's what's that company's name?
Yeah.
Yes, great app. I'm very happy with it. But I love the folks at Smile Software, so I picked this app up. I think it's on sale for $4.99, and syncs over iCloud. And of course, you can send it right to Evernote. It has Evernote integration right built in too. So I'm really happy with it.
It's a good time for iOS apps.
Well, this is the week. This week and next week, you will see a lot of point upgrades. It'll be because everybody had their big updates last week. I guess the time of recording, it'll be So this is like this is now bug fix time because like on a Pocket Cast, I have some bugs. Like it doesn't seem to be downloading in the background, and they said that they had some edge cases that they're fixing. So I must be hitting the edge case.
Yeah. So do we have anything else? Is that our thing for today?
If you're Evernote Essentials 4.0 came out, so if you're into going with our Evernote theme, our friend of the show, Brett Kelly, released an update to his great Evernote book, and if you're a current customer, you get a free copy. You should already have an email. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. And I was a guest host on The Prompt this week, the great show on the 5x5 network with Federico Vitici, Mike Hurley, and Stephen Hackett. We was pretty rough on Mike about his photo library. His camera roll is 7 gigs.
Oh. Ouch.
Yeah. Well, then it turns out that Casey Liss, one of the co-hosts of the Accidental Tech podcast, he had 24 gigs on his camera roll.
That's somebody who likes their video. I think that's only going to get worse with the new slow-mo video in the iPhone 5S.
I agree. And of course, again, I have obviously a lot of thoughts that Apple should do more. Like, I think that the way that Mike and Casey handle their photos, like, actually should work. Like, you should be able to store all your photos on your device. Like, Apple should maybe take those and suck those up to the cloud and, you know, free up some local storage. Mm-hmm. But maybe with iOS 8.
We can only live in hope.
So what conference are you at?
I'm speaking at SecondConf in Chicago here. This is the... I feel bad for them because they keep getting described as being the successor to the old C4 conference. But in fact, I think now they've probably been more second comps than there ever were C4s. I'm not sure. But it's unusual for me. It's mostly a tech conference. Excuse me again. And what I'm doing is I'm giving the sort of opening presentation this year. And what I'm doing is I'm doing a talk called Design Considerations for Educational Apps. And what is included in that talk is basically design and organizational pointers for people who think their apps could be useful in school. And I think one of the key points I'm going to make is that even if you're not making an app that you're going to put in the educational section of the store, don't ignore this, because your app could certainly be useful in school, regardless of whether or not you consider it to be an educational app with a capital E. So I'm looking forward to doing that talk. There's a bunch of other people are here. Jim Dalrymple's closing the show on Sunday, and I think it's going to be a good weekend. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, good deal. Well, I guess that we'll close the show there and let you go get some more coffee.
Yes, indeed. I'm going to try and find some patriotic American music to play us out. I was browsing the United States Air Force Military Band website this morning to try and find something. And I think, being the U.S. Air Force, one of the coolest features is that all their instruments can be played remotely from a bunker in Nevada. So we'll see what we can find from their website as well. But yeah, God bless America.
All right. USA, USA, USA. Everybody has a great week. You can get in touch with us at outofschool.net, and all the show notes will be there, all the links we talked about, and there's a contact form on there as well.
Awesome.
So, I guess that wraps it up.
Have a good week.